Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting the new dramatic series In Treatment, Monday through Friday at 9:30 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Super Tuesday is just a few days away. 41% of Republican delegates and 52% of Democratic delegates are at stake. In a tight race, every delegate counts. But each party has different rules for choosing delegates, and those rules vary from state to state. Complicating matters even further this year is the fact that Florida and Michigan scheduled early primaries in violation of both the Democratic and Republican Party rules. The Democratic Party says it won't seat delegates from either state. The Republican Party is more lenient in its punishment. It's seating 50% of the delegates from Michigan and Florida. Meanwhile, John Edwards dropped out of the race yesterday without endorsing any candidate, and Rudy Giuliani ended his campaign with an endorsement of John McCain. We're going to talk about the primary system, how delegates are chosen, and what part they play in choosing their party's nominee. My guest, David Rohde, is a professor of political science at Duke University. He's written extensively about the political process. So now that Edwards has dropped out of the race, what options do his delegates have?
They're essentially free agents. They can support either of the remaining major candidates, or they can wait.
And are they obliged at all to follow his lead?
No, not at all. They become essentially uncommitted delegates now. But Edwards has very few delegates, and we're now down to two candidates. So the possibility that this is going to go all the way to the convention becomes very, very slim. And so it is likely that either in the wake of Super Tuesday or within the next month, we're likely to have an outcome, and therefore Edwards, either his recommendations or his delegates, aren't likely to have a lot of influence.
Now let's look at Giuliani. He's dropped out. He's supporting John McCain. So his delegates aren't obliged to support McCain. How do you think his dropping out affects how the primary will shape up for Republicans?
His departure has a somewhat different dynamic than the Democratic race, because we are not yet down to two candidates. One might say we're down to two and a half now, that with Huckabee being the half candidate. And Giuliani's departure no longer divides the moderate vote in the Republican Party, but Huckabee still being in divides the conservative vote. So it's Giuliani's departure is a bigger advantage for McCain than Edwards' departure is for either of the Democratic candidates.
Now, experts had been saying that it's mathematically impossible that Super Tuesday would be decisive in choosing the Democratic or Republican nominee. Does that change at all with Giuliani and Edwards dropping out?
That statement was true and remains true in the largely irrelevant sense that no candidate will have a majority of the number of delegates to the entire conventions, in the Democratic case, something over 2,000. But that's not what these events do. The events set the stage for what will obviously follow. And so if one candidate wins decisively on Super Tuesday, that candidate will be the Democratic nominee, whether or not they have a mathematical majority of the delegates or not.
How did Super Tuesday get started?
It's the consequence of a whole series of events. Before 1972, the nomination process in both parties were dominated by party organizations and what are generally pejoratively called party bosses, leaders of state level and local organizations who candidates appealed to them for support, and then the combination of their decisions determined who would win nominations. In the wake of the Democratic convention of 1968, the riots in Chicago and things like that, the process moved to put more influence in the hands of rank-and-file voters. That shifted the process in favor of primaries. The number of primaries tripled in the wake of that decision. And so it was when the number of primaries proliferated that the tradition of Super Tuesday came to the fore.
Were there states that didn't have primaries?
Well, before 1972, three quarters of the states didn't have primaries. They had caucuses and party conventions where delegates were selected. So relatively narrow and low-level public participation. There were a handful of very prominent primaries, of course, New Hampshire being the best known. New Hampshire was first ever since they first held the primary in 1920. And so primaries were a potentially consequential but comparatively minor influence on the nomination process.
Florida and Michigan jumped ahead in the primary schedule this year against their party's wishes, and their parties are penalizing them. The Democrats say that they won't seat any of the Democratic delegates from those states, and Republicans are seating only 50% of the delegates that would have gone to the convention. Has this ever happened before, that states were penalized for leapfrogging ahead?
No, not like this. Both parties tried to institute some controls this time in order to mitigate the front-loading that was going on. So the effort is a recent event, and therefore the penalties are a recent event.
What are some of the consequences that these Democratic and Republican decisions might have about Michigan and Florida delegates? For example, if the primary races remain very close, then say the Democrats could decide, well, we're going to allow Michigan and Florida to be counted after all, and that might be a decisive factor. Or the Republicans might decide we're going to allow that other 50% of delegates from Michigan and Florida to be seated, and that could be decisive. And it could be seen almost as if the party would be fixing it at that point to have the outcome that they wanted, depending on how they treat Michigan and Florida.
What you describe could indeed happen, although as I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that races will remain close. I think we will have nominees. But the convention is a judge of its own membership. So there are often in the past have been disagreements about what set of delegates should be seated. This was especially true in the days when caucuses and conventions dominated. And so there would be competing delegations determined at a convention, and then they would in effect appeal that decision to the national convention. So yes, if things aren't determined, let's say based on what happened in the Florida primary, the Clinton forces could argue that they should receive the lion's share of delegates from Florida and that those delegates should be seated at the convention. And the convention will make a judgment about that. I think it's very likely that the convention is going to end up seating delegates from Michigan and from Florida. But that will mainly be because their decisions won't influence the outcome.
And you think if their decisions would influence the outcome, they'd be less likely to be seated?
Well, there'd be a big fight over whether they should be seated or not.
Why isn't there a consistent way of choosing delegates state by state? And there's no consistency between the two parties either. Republicans have their way. Democrats have their way. And so it seems as if people's votes are uneven. People have a different amount of voting power depending on where they live and what party they belong to.
Right. This is mainly a consequence of the federal system and history. So the convention system goes back to 1832. And so since the federal system left the regulation of most things dealing with elections during the 1800s and 1900s to the states at the state level, each of the states made their own decisions about what was the best way to do things. And that has largely been maintained up to the present day. As I described earlier, since the 1970s, the national organizations, the national convention has imposed some restrictions on the states. And so there's a window during which things have to take place, and there's a proliferation of primaries and things like that. But these are still mostly decisions made at the state level. And therefore, since you have 51, counting the District of Columbia, 51 entities within each party, you get a wide variety of decisions.
Why don't you run through some of the differences between state by state and between the two parties in terms of how delegates are chosen?
Sure. I'll start with the Democrats because given the national reforms that they put in 1972, there's more similarity across the states there. The Democrats leave to the states the decision about whether or not to have primaries or caucuses. overwhelmingly, the states have chosen to have primaries. There are about, in any given election year, 35 to 40 primaries. The remainder are caucuses. Within each state, a certain number of delegates are allocated statewide. The rest are allocated by congressional district. And within those allocations, that is, to take an example, North Carolina, there'd be a certain number of delegates determined statewide. A candidate would have to win 15% of the popular vote statewide to have any share in those delegates. And among the candidates who did get 15% or more, the delegates are allocated proportionally to the vote among them. The same thing is done within the state, within each congressional district. And each candidate would have to win 15% of the vote within the congressional district to have a share of that district's delegates. And among those candidates, they're divided proportionally. Now, you can see that once the number of candidates is winnowed down to two or three, the proportional allocation really is important in determining how much strength candidates are going to have and whether they have a chance to determine the nomination. So if all of the primary results are very close, the delegate totals will be very close. If one candidate dominates the popular vote in the primaries, they're going to dominate the delegates.
What about the Republicans?
Well, because the Republicans didn't go through the same reform effort that the Democrats did, there's less of a regularity across the states. So first of all, the Republicans don't use proportional representation for most of their states. A lot of states are determined on a winner-take-all basis, either statewide, as was done in the recent Florida primary, or by congressional district. And so in Super Tuesday that's coming up, both New York and New Jersey are winner-take-all by state. So if one candidate gets even one more popular vote than the other candidate, they get 100% of the delegates from that state. California on Super Tuesday is winner-take-all by congressional district. And so within any congressional district, a candidate who wins the most votes gets all of the delegates within that district. Then, in addition to this, other states have proportional primaries or they have caucuses, some of which are winner-take-all, some of which are proportional. And again, these decisions all reflect choices made by either state governments or party organizations at the state level.
Some delegates are special delegates and they remain uncommitted. For example, the Democratic Party has superdelegates and about 20% of the delegates at the convention will be superdelegates. What are they?
Superdelegates in the Democratic Party are party officials of one sort or another. That is, they're either members of the Democratic National Committee or they're office holders or, in a few cases, former office holders. So, for example, Bill Clinton is a superdelegate by virtue of having been president of the United States as a Democrat. So all of the Democratic members of the House, all of the Democratic members of the Senate, all of the Democratic governors, and all the members of the DNC, plus a smattering of former office holders, 796 this time around.
What's the rationale behind having about 20% of the delegates be these superdelegates?
This is a consequence of the reform effort in the 1970s, because one of the things that happened because delegate choice was put in the hands of the public was that in some cases party leaders were being left out because they had backed the wrong horse within the state. In 1984, the Democrats decided to put in these superdelegates to make sure that party officials, office holders would always have an influence, be able to exercise some sort of independent judgment. Again, it hasn't been very consequential since the nominations have been determined very early, and therefore they never got around to making any kind of independent judgment.
But it's possible we'll get to see the superdelegates in action if it's a tight race.
That's right. It is possible. And in any event, they are also an independent force for decision making for other matters that the convention could potentially decide, matters of platform or of future party rules and things like that. Those are other judgments that the convention makes.
The Republican Party has their version of the superdelegates, but there's a much smaller number of people that fit into that category. What's the Republican version?
The Republicans actually have two categories. The strict analog to superdelegates are the members of the Republican National Committee, around 160 people. And they are, again, by virtue of their office, automatically delegates, and this is determined at the national level. Also, however, individual states have decided to allocate delegates to uncommitted status, where they also tend to fill these with party officials and office holders. And so there are a number of states where not all of the delegates are determined by the primary or caucus. Some of them are left to exercise an independent judgment. For example, on Super Tuesday, Minnesota and Colorado are two states where a big chunk of the delegates that are allocated to those states are going to be end up unpledged after the results on Super Tuesday.
I think that there are some Democrats who still really wish that Al Gore was the nominee. And some people are wondering, well, if it's really tight and inconclusive, is there any way that Gore could step in? Is there any way that that could possibly happen? Are these people ridiculous in even believing in that possibility?
Well, I certainly don't like to call people ridiculous. I think that what I try to do as a political scientist is to distinguish things that are possible from things that are probable. There are a lot of things that are logically possible that are unlikely to occur. Indeed, as I've emphasized, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that things would actually get to the convention for a decision. But it could happen. And if things aren't determined, to be sure, anybody could announce, say, I want to be the Democratic nominee for president, and then the convention would choose. Some states, either in state law or in party rules, try to restrict the choice of delegates and say that they are pledged for two or three ballots or until the candidate releases them or something like that. But individual delegates at the convention, within the constraints that the possibility of some being legally bound, they can make whatever choice they want. But especially in the Democratic Party, these delegates have been vetted and chosen by the candidates to whom they are pledged. And so they're, by and large, likely to stay loyal. But if new information became available, if new events occurred, if something happened to lead them to think that they should change their mind, it's possible for the convention to do that. So Al Gore could, you know, the day the convention convenes, announce as a candidate, and if the delegates really wanted to, they could choose him as their nominee.
So legally it would be possible to just bypass the whole primary process and announce 5 minutes before the end? I realize how improbable any of this ever
sure.
is, but it's there's no rules against it.
Well, like I said, there are – in many cases, there are rules that bind the delegates, either rules in state law or in state-level party rules. But whether those are enforceable or not is a question, whether they're practically enforceable, even if they're enforceable legally. I mean, in any event, the enforcement would be done after the fact in that, so the convention would have made its judgment. But like I say, these people are going to the convention committed to candidates. And so except for those like the superdelegates that are determined to make an independent judgment, most of the delegates are going to stick with what they were pledged to do because that's what they want to do in any event.
A lot of people who live in states with big cities, and I'd include New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, California, are very frustrated that the early primaries are in states that don't have cities comparable to that. And they feel that the early momentum is geared toward small towns and suburbs as opposed to people in big cities. Is it being done that way for a reason? Is that intentional?
I think it has been done for a reason, and I think it is intentional. And the reason is to maintain the possibility that somebody who is not very widely known at the beginning of the process, a senator or governor from a smaller state, somebody who's relatively new on the national scene, that those people are given an opportunity to make their case to the American people and show that they have support that they can then build on. And I think that actually the current process does work that way, especially this year, that people who produce surprise victories in early events like Iowa and New Hampshire are brought to the attention of the nation, but they don't automatically have success because of that. I mean, Huckabee is a good example this time around, that nationally almost no one had heard of Huckabee. His victory in Iowa catapulted him to attention. He moved up in the polls, but now he started to trail off. But at least the national frontrunner wasn't automatically the winner. And I would note that in the Republican Party, that was Rudy Giuliani, who was up for a long time the national frontrunner and is now not a candidate at all.
Well, David Rohde, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
David Rohde is a professor of political science at Duke University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. My guest, Adrian Tomina, is a comic book artist best known for his series Optic Nerve. He's been publishing since he was a teenager, but his new book, Shortcomings, is his first graphic novel. It's about a 29-year-old Japanese-American named Ben Tanaka, whose girlfriend, Miko, accuses him of being more attracted to white women than to Asian-Americans. The book is filled with funny observations about love and identity politics. I'd love to show you his illustrations, but since I can't do that, how about a short enactment of the dialogue? We've called on the Fresh Air Players, our associate producer Patty Leswing, and Fresh Air alum Ian Chillog, to perform an excerpt from the beginning of the book. Ben's girlfriend Miko has organized an Asian American film festival. Ben and Miko are leaving a screening of a film about a young Asian American woman who has just bonded with her grandfather and now understands his haiku-like wisdom. The audience loved it, but not Ben.
Did you really like that?
I guess it was kind of corny, but yeah.
I can't believe that was supposed to be the best of the festival. Talk about a big fish in a small pond.
Well, we had more submissions than ever before.
Yeah, of digital videos made by Asian Americans who happen to live around here. Didn't they also have to be left-handed or something?
We worked really hard to put this festival together.
I know. I'm not criticizing you. I'm criticizing the crappy movie. Am I allowed to voice my opinion?
You don't have to. You made it perfectly clear with all your fidgeting and groaning. And I'm sure Link could hear you snickering throughout her film.
It's good for her. You can't control an audience's reaction.
Well, it's a little embarrassing for me. And really, who are you to criticize?
Hey, I know a lot more about movies than she does. I'm in the industry.
The industry? You manage a theater.
That's right, a real movie theater, where none of these movies are good enough to play at.
Look, if you didn't like the movie, that's fine. I don't understand why you have to get so angry.
Because everyone knows it's garbage, but they clap for it anyway because it was made by some Chinese girl from Oakland. I mean, why does everything have to be some big statement about race? Don't any of these people just want to make a movie that's good?
God, you drive me crazy sometimes. It's almost like you're ashamed to be Asian.
What? After a movie like that, I'm ashamed to be human.
Okay, let's just drop it.
I wanted a reading of that part because I think it just like frames the whole graphic novel so perfectly. Since race is at the center of this particular conversation, you know, there are so many festivals now, black, Jewish, Asian, revolving around personal identity. Why did you want to open the comic there with the friction around a kind of ethnic identity-oriented film festival?
I think I was using that as a starting point, as a negative example in a way of what I was going to set out to do in the next 100 pages, as someone who's attended a number of those types of festivals and events, I think that was definitely on my mind as I decided to finally do a book that would take up the challenge that so many people had put to me in the past of addressing some issues of race within my work.
Why did you use that in opposition to what you wanted to do? What did you want to do different?
Pretty much everything. First of all, I wanted the work to be judged based on its own qualities, not for an easy message that it sends. I have to agree with Ben in some regards that I think there are some works of art that are praised more because we are agreeing with the message that it's making rather than the quality of the work itself. And I think that's what I was trying to avoid. I think I was, you know, for many years I'd been almost taken to task about sort of avoiding, almost as if I'd been consciously tiptoeing around the issue of race in my work. And I think once I finally decided to attempt that, I wanted to do something that was consistent with the work that I'd done in the past, and wasn't all of the sudden me getting up on a soapbox and pontificating about things that I'm sure most of my readers already know.
Well, you know, in some of your earlier work, the character who was your surrogate and was wearing glasses didn't really have eyes. He was either wearing sunglasses and you couldn't see his eyes, or you saw his glasses, but you didn't, his regular glasses, but there was nothing beneath it. You didn't see any eyes at all, just the glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a way to avoid any kind of ethnic identity? Like if eyes reveal Asian identity and there's no eyes, who knows?
Right, right.
Yeah,
that's sort of been held up as Exhibit A a lot in people's accusations towards me, and I think that really so much of the discussions that arose once I started working publicly were a surprise to me, and that was one of the surprises, because I was, in terms of the artwork, just working in a pretty old cartooning tradition of when someone puts on glasses, they just almost are opaque, and that goes through a lot of the comics that I was reading at the time, but also back to things like probably my earliest inspiration, which was Peanuts by Charles Schulz. You look at the character of Marcy, and she just has kind of opaque white glasses. So I think that was about the extent of my planning in that regard. And then it's been brought up quite a bit as if it was some attempt to hide my background, which it seems a little bit strange, because it wasn't like I was some recluse who never allowed myself to be seen by the public or anything.
Is this the most personal comic that you've done? And if so, do you feel more exposed by it, because the comic has so much to do with both ethnic identity and sexual identity and sexual life?
It is the most personal thing I've done, not in the way that it's the least explicitly autobiographical thing that I've done. I've done other stories in the past that have been almost literal transcriptions from my life, but they're about absolutely mundane occurrences like changing a flat tire or something like that. So in that case, you don't feel exposed at all. You feel great confidence being completely truthful and honest. But with this story, it's not literal in its depiction of my life, but I definitely open myself up in a lot of ways and put thoughts of mine and observations into the fictional world. And I have to say that I don't think this is the kind of book that I could have written even 5-6 years ago, because I think that at that point in my life I was still very concerned about how the work would reflect upon me as a person. And I have to admit that there were times where I was thinking of an imagined audience reading the work and thinking, oh, the guy who wrote this must be so sensitive and he must be a smart guy or something. And I think it was really useful for me to have this sort of turning point in my thought process where I was not so concerned about that. And it was very liberating to be able to say, like, well, you know, some people might not respond so well to this, but I still feel compelled to put it on paper. And I think that's what really allowed me to create this book.
So you wanted people not only to like your work, but to like the author, to think that the author was a swell and decent and enlightened man.
Yeah.
And you
well,
had to
you
stop
know,
worrying about that.
Well, you know, most normal boys, as they're growing up, they in order to become attractive, they might, you know, get good at sports or join a rock band or develop good social skills. And for some reason, I thought that drawing comic books might be might be my route. And you know, I guess it goes without saying that that was sort of a misguided endeavor, especially in high school. But that was definitely on my mind. I think that I've referred to there being a flirtatious quality in some of my older work that kind of makes me cringe when I go back and look at it.
Flirting with who?
Some imagined audience. You know, I probably some girl that I thought that I would someday meet or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's even when I was creating stories in the past that had some questionable characters, I feel like there's just still this sense that me as the creator of those characters is somehow judging them, or is I'm showing their bad behavior, and then somehow subtly I'm implying that, well, I'm criticizing that, and aren't I much more enlightened than this guy? And you know, I think that can really be a dead end. I think artistically, I mean, maybe it'll lead to something in your real life, but in terms of the art, I think that's a real trap that you can get sucked into, and I felt myself going down that path for sure.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Adrian Tumina, and he's a comic book artist, graphic artist, and his new graphic novella is called Shortcomings. You know, one of the things I really like about the comic book as a form is the thought balloon, because it's like the interior and the exterior. It shows how you're looking, but it also shows what's going on inside, what you're thinking. And I think in that sense, it's something that's really unique to the comic, unless there's like a voiceover in a movie. What do you really love about comic books that you think you couldn't do in any other medium?
Well, the type of cartooning that I think is generally referred to as alternative or underground is usually the distinction is usually in terms of whether it's made by one person, the entire thing is done by one hand, or more of a production line process, which is how the comics that we grew up reading were made. And I think that if you are looking at a comic that's made by one person, that there's just a level of intimacy that I don't really see anywhere else. And it's, you know, I think it's just physically impossible to make a movie or to stage a play completely by yourself, whereas something like a comic book can be done by one hand. And I think that when you have one person making it and one person reading it very, very privately, I think it creates an interesting dynamic. I mean, just the experience of the communal experience of watching a movie or a play versus sitting quietly and reading a comic on your own certainly colors the perception of the work.
Your mother is a psychology professor, right?
That's right. She was a psychology professor. She's retired from that, but she
okay.
was.
I
should also mention that my wife works in a mental hospital here in New York.
Wow. Uh-huh. Well, I'm thinking, you know, anybody who works in psychology or with mental health, that's a very thought balloon kind of process, because it's about getting to what's really in that thought balloon as opposed to what's being said. You know, it's about mm-hmm. what's going inside as opposed to the public face. And I couldn't help but wonder if your early exposure to the idea of psychology, to the fact that there are things going on inside somebody that you don't necessarily have access to, made you more interested in that kind of thought balloon type of approach to the world.
I think so. I think that's a really good observation that, you know, I think a lot of people point to the fact that I was an English major in college as that being some sort of starting point for the style that I work in now. But I think that really there is a profound effect from growing up in a home where just the idea of psychology even exists. You know, I mean, I think there are people who don't have that experience or where it's dismissed. And just at a young age to be exposed to the idea that I guess that's right, that there are thoughts that are not readily apparent, and I think that the thought bubble is a good analogy for that.
Now, you were self-publishing in high school. What did that mean, going to Kinko's and getting copies made and handing them out?
Yeah, I self-publishing seems like a bit of a grand description of what it was, because it literally was taking a sketchbook to Kinko's and making, I think the first one I did had a print run of 25, and you know, a handful of those were given to family members, and the rest are still sitting in a box in my closet. And it slowly built from there. But you know, even that first experience of self-publishing was it really had an impact on me, because it certainly wasn't the same as you know, doing something that's going to be published all over the world. But I think when you're just starting out, it has that feeling, and even though there were only 25 little Xerox pamphlets, suddenly it seemed a lot more real, and it seemed like it could be held up to scrutiny that it wouldn't have had if it was just hidden away in my sketchbook. And that was really the start of a very long and ongoing process of sort of, I guess, self-critique or self-analysis in terms of my work.
It sounds like it was really an issue for you being judged by other people. Yeah, as a person and as an artist.
Yeah, I think you should probably talk to my mom about that. I think it's hard to not be affected by that. I have to, especially with this book, Shortcomings, I had to go through some sort of mind games on myself in a way to shut out the thoughts of it being seen, because, like I said, I was trying to move away from that that great self-consciousness that I felt was creeping into my work. So it was almost like I had to trick myself into thinking that I was working just for myself, like when I started out, and now it's out there for the whole world to see.
In one of your earlier works, your main character, who's a comic book artist, gets an assignment, and the editor says, "All we're looking for is more of that sad, romantic, angsty stuff that everybody loves." And do you think that, like, indie comic books have, like, developed their own cliches that you have to avoid now?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm at the forefront of some of those cliches being established. I know there's a lot of people who have pared down this type of work into either, you know, like a leaf slowly falling from a tree, or a guy sitting in his room with a tear coming down his cheek. And I understand where those jokes are coming from, for sure. I think that if I was somehow frozen in the mindset of being 21 years old and lonely and sad and all that, then I think that I would just run that right into the ground, that I would be doomed to a career of self-parody. But I think, fortunately, you know, time progresses, I've certainly evolved as a person, and so, like I said, I don't feel the need to use art just as a way to declare my loneliness or something like that.
One more question. In a couple of your comics, you mentioned that you discovered as a kid the hard way that you're really allergic to peanut butter and to peanuts.
That's right.
I mean, just to anything,
yep.
Any trace of peanut. And I can't help but think that would make you go through life, if you're a certain kind of person, feeling more vulnerable and more set apart, because it's what's an everyday experience, lunch, for so many people, particularly kids, peanut butter and jelly, is this kind of like death-defying act, I mean, for you. I mean, you'd get really super sick if you had that. And so it means that, like, it's this vulnerability to ordinary things. You have to be careful. You have to be guarded about at least that one thing, in a way that other people don't, which means maybe you have to be guarded about other things too, that maybe you have this like super sensitive body, and that has like all these implications to it.
Yeah, I think you've pinpointed a lot of what's formed my personality over the years, because you know, I've always said that I got into drawing comics in response to basically not having anything better to do, and I think that circumstance arose even at an early age from not feeling like I could, you know, dash out onto the playground or go into the cafeteria with the same sense of abandon as other kids might have. And it's such a severe allergy. It's not that I would eat it and get sick or something. It really is a life-threatening allergy. And so it's pretty weird to be a little kid and be aware of the fact that you could die with one misstep, just on the playground or something like that. And obviously there's no way to raise a kid and not tell him about that, not have him be cautious. But it certainly has had its impact on me.
Well, if it made you stay home and do good comic books, at least you got something good.
That's true.
I mean, the bad out of it.
Yeah, the payoff was slow.
Yes, right, exactly. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Adrian Tumina's new graphic novel is called Shortcomings. The ABC drama series Lost returns to TV tonight after 8 months, picking up where last May's unexpected cliffhanger left off. The castaways on that mysterious island now have rescuers on the way who may not be rescuers at all. Meanwhile, Lost itself may be network TV's biggest hope of rescue from the current writer's strike. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Last year, with its third season finale and a surprise announcement a few months later, the producers of ABC's Lost made some bold new moves. The final episode of 2007 ended with a surprise revelation. The subplot involving Matthew Fox's Jack, seen going through some tough times back in Los Angeles, was not an off-the-island flashback, an established part of each episode till then, but a flash-forward. That meant that Jack and Kate, also seen in this flash-forward, survived and got off the island. It meant that the writers could go in a whole new direction. Now the future, as well as the past and present, was open to them. And on top of that bombshell, the creators of Lost soon added another. They announced a schedule for the remainder of the series, 3 seasons of 16 episodes, 48 episodes in all, that would run without interruption each year and would, by the end, wrap up the story of the Oceanic Airline passengers. So far, so great. With an end in sight, the writers could pace themselves and serve as storylines and characters the way very few drama series, especially ones so full of questions and mysteries, get to do. But then came the writer's strike. Now, as Lost returns this week, it's planning to present only 8 of the originally scheduled 16 episodes this season. Whether those other 8 shows will be added to the remainder of the run, or will be, in a word, lost, has yet to be determined. But if we look at Lost the TV series, in the same way it's now telling stories, looking at the future as well as the present and past, we can predict that this series and tonight's episode are pivotal when it comes to the history of network television. The Writers Guild of America strike is close to entering its 4th month. Today also is the start of the February ratings sweeps, a month-long period in which the ratings a program delivers are used to set advertising rates for the following fiscal quarter. There are some big-ticket special events in the February sweeps, the Super Bowl, the Oscars, the Grammys, even the continuation of American Idol. But when it comes to scripted drama, nothing comes close to Lost. Lost right now is the poster child for broadcast network TV shows written by real writers, directed by real directors, and acted by talented actors. During the strike, it's almost like a remote island of its own, surrounded by swampy sludge like American Gladiators, Moment of Truth, and NBC's newest, tackiest unscripted competition series, My Dad is Better Than Your Dad. In a contest called My Network is Better Than Your Network, NBC wouldn't even qualify. So the future of network TV, in no small way, is tied up with the success of tonight's Lost. ABC has built it, but will we come? If we want more shows like this on the broadcast networks of tomorrow, we almost have to. Luckily, the opener itself is fabulous. For viewers, it's been 8 months since the last events on Lost took place, but on the show itself, it's been mere seconds. Jack has used a communications device from someone who parachuted onto the island to summon help, which is on the way. That communication was made possible because Charlie and Desmond invaded an underwater platform and turned off an island-wide jamming device. And as the show opens, Desmond returns in a canoe with a frantic message he wants to get to Jack about the would-be rescuers. Other familiar characters, Saeed, Sawyer, Bernard, Juliet, help Desmond beach his canoe and pepper him with questions. But only Hurley, who runs to the canoe while they're all talking, asks the most important question of all, about his best friend Charlie, who died in last season's cliffhanger. No one but Desmond knows that yet, but they're about to find out.
We need to get the Jack. We can't let him get in touch with our boat.
It's easy, Scotty. Everything's cool. Boat's on the way.
What? On the way? No.
Hey, it was Charlie.
No, that woman, Naomi, she lied. The people on the boat aren't who they say they are.
What?
And who are they?
I don't know, but we need to get in touch with Jack now!
Wait. It's all right, we can call him. We have a walkie. It's okay.
Well, where is it? Get it.
What do you mean if people aren't who they say?
Where's Charlie?
I'm sorry, brother.
I've seen the first two episodes of the new season. Sadly, that's 25% of the expected total. And they do everything you'd want Lost to do. They service old characters and, yes, introduce new ones. They shed light on some old mysteries and, yes, throw out some tantalizing new ones. We learn how many other castaways got off the island with Jack and Kate, but we don't yet know how or, except for the identity of one other, which ones. And as for whether the rescuers are what they seem, put it this way. Has anything on Lost ever been what it seemed?
David Bianculli writes about television for TVWorthWatching.com.